Have you ever found yourself inexplicably moved to tears by a melancholy melody, or felt a strange, piercing joy while watching autumn leaves fall? Susan Cain's Bittersweet explores this peculiar emotional state that many of us experience but rarely discuss. The book has resonated deeply with celebrities like Brené Brown and Adam Grant, who praise its ability to articulate feelings that often go unnamed. Since its 2022 release, it has become a cultural touchstone for those seeking to understand the power of embracing both joy and sorrow. Drawing on psychology, neuroscience, and spiritual traditions spanning continents and centuries, Cain challenges our culture's relentless pursuit of happiness by revealing how our most profound moments of connection often emerge from acknowledging life's impermanence. As Cain writes, "The bittersweet is about the desire for communion, the wish to go home. In a world increasingly divided by toxic positivity and perfectionism, this book offers a radical alternative. What if our sorrows and longings are not weaknesses to overcome, but gateways to our deepest humanity?" In the haunting opening of Bittersweet, Cain introduces us to Vedran Smilovich, the cellist who played Albinoni's Adagio amid sniper fire during the Bosnian War. For 22 days, one for each victim killed at a bombed bakery, he sat in formal concert attire among the rubble while violence raged around him. When other musicians joined, they didn't play martial or uplifting music, but the bittersweet Albinoni. This powerful image establishes the book's central premise. There is transformative power in acknowledging sorrow through beauty. The bittersweet state, a tendency toward longing, poignancy, and sorrow, an acute awareness of passing time, and a piercing joy at the world's beauty, opens a path to creativity, connection, and transcendence. While American culture prizes cheerfulness and assertiveness, the bittersweet melancholic mode recognizes that light and dark are forever paired. Longing isn't passive, but active, creative, and divine. To help readers assess their inclination toward bittersweetness, Cain developed a quiz with research scientists Dr. David Yaden and Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. Questions measure emotional sensitivity, such as tearing up at commercials, being moved by old photographs, reacting intensely to music, finding comfort in rainy days, and seeing both happiness and sadness simultaneously. High scores correlate with traits like sensitivity, absorption, which predicts creativity, and spirituality. The bittersweet tradition has been dramatically overlooked despite being brimming with human potential. Our poets and philosophers have been trying to tell us for centuries that our longing is the gateway to belonging. Many religious traditions teach that yearning is the path to the divine, whether you call it the perfect and beautiful world, the Garden of Eden, or simply home. When Pixar director Pete Docter was creating Inside Out, he initially planned to make fear the protagonist alongside joy. 3 years into development, with dialogue completed and animation underway, Docter realized something fundamental wasn't working. Facing what he thought would be career failure, he sank into sadness and had an epiphany. Emotions exist to connect us, with sadness being the ultimate bonding agent. Despite concerns that executives would find sadness too glum for a starring role, Docter rewrote the film with sadness at its heart. The resulting movie won an Oscar and became Pixar's highest-grossing original film. Dacher Keltner, the Berkeley psychology professor who advised on the film, appears joyfully but describes sadness as at the core of who I am. His research reveals that the compassionate instinct is hardwired into our nervous systems. We literally respond to others' pain as if it were our own. The word compassion means to suffer together, and this capacity for shared sorrow creates our deepest bonds. This instinct is embedded throughout our evolutionary biology, in the anterior cingulate region, the human part of the brain, in the mammalian periaqueductal gray, which drives maternal nurturing, and most fundamentally, in the ancient vagus nerve, connecting brain to body. People with strong vagus nerve activation, vagal superstars, demonstrate greater cooperation, stronger friendships, and more willingness to help others in need. Our compassionate instinct originated with the mother-child bond, our visceral response to crying infants. Human babies are the most vulnerable offspring on the face of the earth, born prematurely to accommodate our large brains. This evolutionary trade-off means that as our species grew more intelligent, we necessarily became more sympathetic to care for our helpless young. Darwin, who lost his 10-year-old daughter Annie, wrote in The Descent of Man that compassion is our strongest instinct, describing it as the simple result of the greater strength of the social or maternal instincts than that of any other instinct or motive. The Dalai Lama was astonished by the similarities between Darwin's views and Tibetan Buddhism. Both see in compassion as the greatest virtue, with the mother-infant bond at its heart. If we could honor sadness more, we might see it, rather than enforced smiles or righteous outrage, as the bridge connecting us to others, remembering that everyone has suffered or will suffer. Our deep yearning for perfect love and connection is exemplified by Francesca from the Bridges of Madison County, whose brief affair with a photographer creates a lasting spiritual sustenance. While contemporary wisdom suggests abandoning the notion of soulmates as immature, another tradition views this longing as normal and desirable, not just in romantic contexts, but in our response to music, nature, and spirituality. Philosopher Alain de Botton argues we should renounce the romantic ideal of finding a perfect being who satisfies our every yearning. Through his School of Life seminars, he teaches that relationships are skills we can improve by recognizing our own flaws rather than seeking perfection in others. He insists we're all deeply flawed humans who need growth, not unconditional acceptance. Beyond romantic relationships lies a deeper question about the nature of human longing itself. The bittersweet tradition suggests that yearning exists independently of romantic love. Romance is merely one expression of it. This explains our profound connection to sad music, like the viral video of a 2-year-old boy moved to tears by Moonlight Sonata. Research confirms that bittersweet songs elicit stronger physical responses and deeper connections than happy ones. This preference for melancholy extends across cultures: Portuguese fado, Spanish flamenco, American blues, and contemporary pop music. Even lullabies often contain themes of sadness and impermanence. Our aesthetic preferences for tragic drama, rainy days, and cherry blossoms, valued precisely because they die young, reflect what Japanese culture calls mono no aware, a desired state of gentle sorrow arising from sensitivity to impermanence. The concept of sacred longing has traveled the world for centuries under many different names. The ancient Greeks called it pothos, a yearning for something wonderful yet unattainable that Plato defined as our thirst for everything good and beautiful. C.S. Lewis called it inconsolable longing, or Sehnsucht, that unnameable something that pierces us at the smell of bonfires or sound of wild ducks flying overhead. This yearning appears across traditions: the Spanish duende, Portuguese saudade, Hindu viraha, and Sufi longing for the divine. All share the pain of separation and desire for reunion. In Sufism, longing is seen as the sweet pain of belonging to God. Once longing awakens in the heart, it becomes the most direct path home. The great Sufi Ibn Arabi prayed, "O Lord, nourish me not with love, but with the desire for love," while Rumi expressed the same truth simply, "Do not seek for water, be thirsty." Leonard Cohen's story exemplifies the mysterious connection between creativity, sorrow, and longing. After losing his father at age 9, Cohen created his first artistic expression by burying a poem in his father's bow tie, initiating a lifelong pattern of transforming heartache into art. Though famous for his romantic relationships, Cohen existed best in a state of longing and created his most iconic songs about leave-taking and farewell. Research consistently shows connections between creativity and sorrow. Marvin Eisenstadt's study of 573 creative leaders found an astonishing percentage had been orphaned in childhood. 25% lost at least one parent by age 10, rising to 45% by age 20. Kay Redfield Jamison's research revealed people working in arts are 8 to 10 times more likely to suffer mood disorders. Economist Carl-Jan Borowiecki analyzed 1,400 letters from Mozart, Liszt, and Beethoven, finding their negative emotions, specifically sadness, predicted creative output. In another study, Columbia professor Mudupe Akinola discovered students who faced disapproving audiences created better collages than those who received positive feedback, with the most emotionally vulnerable producing the best work. Beethoven's Ode to Joy exemplifies creativity as a movement from darkness to light. For 3 decades, he worked to set Schiller's poem of freedom and brotherhood to music, composing some 200 versions before finding satisfaction. During these years, Beethoven faced romantic disappointments, a troubled relationship with his nephew, and most devastatingly, the loss of his hearing. By 1801, his letters revealed profound isolation. "I must confess that I am living a miserable life. For almost 2 years, I have ceased to attend any social functions just because I find it impossible to say to people, 'I am deaf.'" At the premiere of his 9th Symphony, Beethoven stood on stage beside the conductor, disoriented and disheveled, gesturing erratically to the orchestra, unable to hear the music. When the performance ended, a young soloist had to turn him around to see the audience on their feet, tears streaming down their faces. Though Schiller's poem was exultant, Beethoven's rendition was laced with sorrow, creating transcendent beauty that moved listeners to their core. We needn't be great artists to transform our struggles creatively. Whether we write, cook, dance, compose, or dream up a business, the point isn't distinction, but transformation. Arts therapy proves effective precisely because it helps people process troubles through creative expression, regardless of artistic merit. The principle becomes clear. Whatever pain you can't get rid of, make it your creative offering, or find someone who makes it for you. Dylan Thomas's line, "Though lovers be lost, love shall not," frames Kane's exploration of coping with lost love, beginning with her personal story of a complex relationship with her mother. Despite being considered polite and responsible by American standards of the 1980s, any rule breaking triggered panicked accusations, anger, floods of tears, and weeks of stony silence from her mother. The author approached home with stomach aches, became skilled at gauging her mother's moods, and felt responsible for maintaining her equilibrium. For decades after a pivotal diary incident in college, mother and daughter maintained superficial contact, phone calls, holiday visits, exchanging "I love you," but trust was broken on both sides. The mother haunted the author's dreams as both menacing and fragile. Their conversations became careful fencing matches, with the author learning to keep emotional distance. She struggled with the common dynamic where a parent tells a child she can be herself or be loved, but not both. Kane shares her story not for its particulars, but because everyone experiences loss. She offers 3 insights from her decades of healing. First, unaddressed losses create patterns that wreak havoc on relationships until consciously reworked. Second, these wounds may remain lifelong vulnerabilities, abandonment fears, insecurity, perfectionism that require ongoing vigilance. Third, and most crucial, the love you lost or the love you wished for and never had, that love exists eternally. It shifts its shape, but it's always there. The task is to recognize it in its new form. Psychologist Stephen Hayes's Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, ACT T, teaches that pain reveals what matters most to us. To open your heart to pain is to open your heart to joy, Hayes explains. ACT T offers 7 skills for coping with loss. 5 involve accepting the bitter, acknowledging loss, embracing emotions, accepting all feelings, expecting overwhelm, and watching for unhelpful thoughts, while 2 transform bitter to sweet, connecting with what matters and taking committed action. Research shows that people who accept negative emotions suffer less stress and enjoy greater well-being even during major life challenges. The crucial step is using pain to identify core values and then acting on them. This transformation is illustrated through figures like Buckminster Fuller, who nearly died by suicide after business failure and his daughter's death, but instead asked what would make life worthwhile and became the Leonardo da Vinci of the 20th century. The wounded healer archetype, coined by Carl Jung in 1951, appears across cultures and myths. From the Greek centaur Chiron, who gained healing powers from his own poisoned wound, to shamanic traditions where healers undergo painful initiations, to religious figures like the suffering Messiah and Jesus, who heals through his own wounds, this pattern repeats throughout human history. Americans smile more than any other society on Earth, while many cultures view constant smiling as dishonest or inviting bad luck. When McDonald's opened in Russia, workers were confused by required cheeriness, explaining, "We are serious about life because life is struggle. We were always a little bit afraid of America's smile." Behind this facade lies a troubling reality. Americans suffer from high rates of anxiety and depression, with 30% experiencing anxiety and 20% major depression over their lifetimes. Unlike other cultures with rituals acknowledging impermanence and sorrow, American sympathy cards feature cheerful colors and sayings like, "Love lives on," rather than acknowledging grief directly. This tyranny of positivity evolved from Calvinism's emphasis on showing one's predestination for heaven through ceaseless labor, to 19th-century commercial expansion that replaced religious predestination with economic predestination. Success became the holy grail, with loser transforming from someone who suffers loss to a contemptible identity reflecting character flaws. The New Thought movement furthered this by promoting relentless positivity as the path to wealth and health. At Princeton, students face the pressure of effortless perfection, appearing successful without visible effort. This manifests academically, appearing underprepared yet successful, socially, fitting in while seeming unique, and emotionally, hiding any signs of struggle or grief. Campus therapist Anna Braverman notes many students mourn what might have been, wishing for supportive families while pretending everything is fine. Similar phenomena exist at other elite universities, Penn Face at Pennsylvania and Duck Syndrome at Stanford. Susan David teaches emotional agility, holding difficult emotions loosely yet courageously before moving past them toward positive change. She sees a tyranny of positivity in workplaces where vulnerability is hidden and tears are shed privately in bathroom stalls. Though naturally joyful herself, David reminds people that wanting to avoid heartbreak or failure means having dead people's goals. Only the dead never experience stress, heartbreak, or disappointment. In business culture, a new narrative is emerging that acknowledges suffering at work. Researchers found workplaces full of unacknowledged pain, with employees using words like angry or frustrated instead of admitting they're sad or suffering. The chronic, everyday suffering triggered by relationships, finances, and office politics remains largely suppressed, though concepts like bringing your whole self to work are gaining traction. Even in macho workplaces like offshore oil rigs, emotional vulnerability can transform culture. Rick Fox, a tough shell oil rig leader, worked with consultant Claire Neuer to face his underlying fear. By normalizing vulnerability, the rig achieved an 84% decline in accidents and sky-high productivity. When Kane's brother died from COVID-19 complications in April 2020, she experienced a profound existential nausea beyond just missing him. This feeling stems from the realization that what once was will never be again, the same insight that made her son cry on his last day of third grade. Despite practicing Stoic philosophy and meditating on impermanence, the reality of death remains overwhelming. How are we supposed to live with such an unthinkable thing? At RadFest, Kane encountered a diverse crowd of immortality seekers, scientists, investors, crystal enthusiasts, and elderly people desperate for more time. Unlike most people who cope with mortality through denial, immortalists face death directly, viewing impermanence as the great wound they must heal. While critics question whether immortality would fundamentally change humanity or create practical problems, the immortalists envision a utopia where curing death leads to solving all human problems, even suggesting that mortality itself drives tribalism and conflict. Japanese Buddhist poet Isa lost his daughter Sato to smallpox before her second birthday. Despite understanding Buddhism's teaching that life is as ephemeral as dewdrops, Isa's famous haiku ends with the powerful protest, "But even so." These three words capture humanity's universal struggle with impermanence. We may intellectually understand life's transience, but emotionally resist it. Rather than seeing this resistance as failure, Kane suggests it's what connects us all. By turning his grief into poetry, Isa invites us into the shared sorrow of being mortal and the communal longing of being human. Contemporary culture has lost the ars moriendi, art of dying, tradition that once helped people face mortality. Since the 1930s, death moved from homes to hospitals, becoming shameful and forbidden. Mourners now shoulder an ethical duty to enjoy oneself and treat grief as morbid self-indulgence, hiding their pain to avoid diminishing others' enjoyment. Dr. Laura Carstensen's research reveals that awareness of impermanence leads to greater happiness and presence. Her studies found older adults report less distress than younger people, focusing on positive rather than threatening stimuli. This positivity effect occurs because the elderly experience poignancy, feeling happy and sad simultaneously, which gives meaning to life. When we know our time is limited, we focus on what matters most, prioritizing love and meaning over ambition. We can access the wisdom of mortality awareness without waiting for old age. Carstensen recommends specific practices: listening to minor key music, meditating on death, observing impermanence in nature, recording elder stories, and following religious traditions like Ash Wednesday or Yom Kippur. Stoic philosophers advocated similar approaches. Marcus Aurelius advised, "You could leave life right now. Let that determine what you do and say and think." Nora McHenerny, who lost her husband to brain cancer, offers a powerful distinction. We don't move on from grief, we move forward with it. She reminds us that grief is this multitasking emotion where sadness and happiness coexist, and that a grieving person is going to laugh again and smile again without ever leaving their loved one behind. Kane explores how we inherit and might transform generational pain, beginning with her experience at a workshop for professionals working with the dying. As workshop participants share their stories of grief, Kane realizes her unexplained tears throughout life might connect to inherited trauma from her family's Holocaust history. Her grandfather had escaped Poland before the Holocaust, but lost his family, carrying that grief his entire life. Dr. Rachel Yehuda's groundbreaking work with Holocaust survivors and their children showed unique patterns, including difficulty with separation from parents, higher rates of PTSD, depression, and anxiety, and even similar hormonal abnormalities as their parents. Yehuda's studies found evidence of methylation in a stress-related gene in both Holocaust survivors and their children, suggesting preconception parental trauma might be inherited. Animal research supports this concept, with studies showing water fleas developing defensive features after parental exposure to predators and mice inheriting fear responses across generations. Professor Isabel Mansu's research demonstrated that traumatized mice passed erratic behaviors to offspring for up to 6 generations, even when raised separately. Importantly, Yehuda emphasizes that if pain can be inherited, healing can be too. These systems are responsive to environment and potentially reversible. Healing inherited trauma takes multiple forms, all involving healthy connections with our ancestors. Yehuda's research shows psychotherapy can produce measurable epigenetic changes, while Mansu found enriched environments prevented traumatized mice from passing distress to offspring. Another way to transform generational pain is by helping others facing similar struggles. Dr. William Breitbart exemplifies this approach. As the son of Holocaust survivors, his life was shaped by events before his birth. Growing up in a community of survivors, Breitbart's childhood was infused with survivor's guilt. "I'm not here to accumulate material wealth. I'm here to ease suffering," he explains. This legacy led him to develop meaning-centered psychotherapy for cancer patients, helping them find fulfillment by learning to love who they are rather than what they've done. At 33, working 16-hour days as a seventh-year associate at a Wall Street law firm, Kane learned she wouldn't make partner. Though devastated at losing her dream of a Greenwich Village townhouse like those owned by senior partners, she recognized this rejection as a get-out-of-jail-free card. Despite her childhood dream of becoming an author, she had pursued corporate law, studying financial terms by candlelight on weekends, believing the sacrifice worthwhile for the life she imagined in those tree-lined streets where poets and novelists once lived. After leaving the law firm, she ended a seven-year relationship and fell into an obsession with a musician named Raoul. Living alone in a sparsely furnished apartment near a 19th-century church, she realized through a friend's insight that Raoul represented the writing life she'd longed for since childhood. The Greenwich Village townhouse had been a misunderstood signpost, not about real estate, but about finding her true home. With this realization, her obsession fell away and she began writing for real. Kane asks readers what they are longing for, their unique imprint, singular mission, or wordless calling. She encourages exploring the meaning behind our symbols and examining how our bittersweet temperaments can transform pain into beauty and longing into belonging. Later, she met Ken, who became her husband, a writer who had worked in UN peacekeeping in war zones, carrying his own longing for a different world. Despite witnessing humanity's darkest moments, Ken recognized and encouraged her writing talent. Their shared longing for the art of peaceful repair connected them despite their different life experiences. Kane returns to the Kabbalistic metaphor of creation as a vessel of divine light that broke apart, with shards of holiness now scattered around us. Our task is to gather these fragments, recognizing that light emerges from darkness. This modest vision doesn't promise utopia, but encourages us to cherish what we have, while bringing the bittersweet tradition to our domains of influence. She concludes by returning to the cellist of Sarajevo and the old man who identified himself only as a musician, not by ethnicity. She shares a personal story about her father's death from COVID, where, at his small graveside service, a young rabbi praised her father's love of God. Though initially skeptical, she realized her father did love God by another name, by many other names. She describes how her father spent his life gathering the shards of the Kabbalah's broken vessel through his love of orchids, French, organic chemistry, and his dedication as a doctor and father. The night her father died, she listened to music, not because she would find him there, but because loving a parent and loving art are different manifestations of the same perfect world. She ends with her father's final words to her, "Be well, kid," and her intention to do just that, hoping readers will do the same.